Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I just thought we should spend the last Dr. Dawn of the year talking about what else happened in 2020 in health and science besides COVID. Oh my God, you mean there was more? Well, today we're going to cover some of the stories that went unnoticed or perhaps underreported and why they matter. We'll start with a couple of short news briefs. And the first of these relates to Ebola. Now, in 2018, there was the beginning of an outbreak of Ebola in Eastern Congo. It killed about two-thirds of the 3,500 people that it infected. And by June, it was done, thanks to an aggressive, organized public health response involving testing, isolating sick people, aggressive contact tracing. Sound familiar? There was also a vaccine delivered to more than 300,000 people during the outbreak. And an experimental drug kind of emerged on October 14th. One of these antibody-based treatments, Inmazeb, became the first Ebola drug approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. So now that drug could maybe become more readily available for Ebola patients. And the drug's maker, Regeneron Pharmaceutical, might be someone who you've heard about recently. I think we're looking at a future full of antibody-based treatments. Another odd thing that cropped up this year was this discovery of individuals who are called HIV elite controllers. It sounds rather ominous and Orwellian, but actually, they found an individual who was infected with HIV who has all on his lonesome, all by himself, managed to wipe out his HIV. They took 1.5 billion blood cells from him, big sample. Not a single working copy of the virus turned up. And in another patient, they found only one functional copy. Learning how these people, these elite controllers, fight off HIV might lead to not just treatment, but cure. And that's some exciting news. Another thing that happened this year was that in January, the FDA approved the first drug for curbing peanut allergies in children and teens. The peanut allergies are a serious big deal. There are at least 6.1 million people in the United States who develop severe allergic reactions to peanuts. That's one in 50 kids and one in 200 adults. Anaphylaxis is no laughing matter. People can develop swelling in their mouth, tongue, lips, hives. Here's where it gets bad. Their airways can close off and they can go into shock as all of the fluid in their blood vessels leaks out into the peripheral tissue. In fact, if you've ever had a hive, that's what's happening, leaky blood vessels. Now, if your whole body turns into one massive hive, you can die. And the treatment for this, prompt aggressive treatment with epinephrine or adrenaline, hence the EpiPen. This drug is a peanut protein, an altered peanut protein, and it's given in escalating amounts so that the body gradually learns to tolerate these proteins. Actually, what happens is that another part of the immune system, the T regulatory cells, gets activated, and the body also begins producing a different type of antibody, IgG, to coat and prevent the IgE, the stuff that causes the anaphylactic reaction, from encountering the antigens. Another thing that happened in 2020 was the discovery of a new gland. Now, just when you thought with MRI, PET scans, genetics, we'd found all the parts, well, afraid not. The tuberileal salivary glands, which are two glands, each about 1.5 inches long and located up behind the back of the nose, right next to where the eustachian tubes pop in from the ear into the lower part of the nose. So they've been there all along. And Vesalius and all the anatomists of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance never found them. None of the people in Victorian England who were so into dissection ever found them. They've been hanging out there in a hard-to-reach place, surrounded by bone, where apparently no man has gone before. We only found them this time because of improvements in our imaging technology. Personally, these salivary glands sitting up there behind the back of the nose are probably stimulated when we smell things, and I really recommend that we rename these the post-nasal drippers. Our next news of 2020 relates to Evolve. Remember Evolve? It was all the thing in 2019. We talked about it quite a bit. This is the e-cigarette product use-associated lung injury. And researchers accidentally, through a serendipitous event, figured out that EVALI isn't from the nicotine, the THC, or the vitamin E oil, which were the prevailing postulates at the last time I talked about this. Instead, it suggests that it actually just depends on the kind of heating element. If the device uses a nickel-chromium alloy heating element, that's where you get injury. It's really kind of amazing. The researchers who were doing this were using an animal model, and they were basically studying Evolve. And when they, in the course of studying, I guess this happened in September of 2019, the e-cigarette device that the team was using went off market. So they had to get a substitute device. The manufacturer offered them a substitute. The new device was physically compatible with the original exposure system, had the same tread on the screw. You could just screw it in and put your specimen in and vape it. But the heating element was a different metal. Instead of stainless steel, it was nickel-chromium alloy. And within an hour of beginning the experiment, the animals were showing evidence of severe respiratory distress, wheezing, panting, and when these poor animals died and their lung tissue was analyzed, they were severely compromised, and they had lung lesions, red blood cell congestion, obliteration of the alveolar space, and pneumonitis in some cases. This was completely serendipitous. They had a baseline using the stainless steel devices, testing all of the candidate additives like the vitamin E and the other things that were postulated as the possible cause. The lung injury actually occurred when you took out the nicotine, the THC, and all the vitamin E additives, and it may also have something to do with the wattage of the power settings on the nickel-chromium E devices, which apparently have a little bit more wattage. I'm not quite sure if that's just because of the nature of the metal. Now, we've known, and we talked about this a lot last year, so I won't belabor the case, that vaping has been proven to be associated with increased blood pressure, damage to the lining of blood vessels, increased risk of heart attack and stroke. And there are a bunch of different heating elements out there, right? Heating elements including stainless steel, the nickel-chromium or nichrome, canthal nickel, and titanium. So now we have to realize, which we've been missing all along, was that it wasn't the contents that were being vaped. It was the additive from the vaping metal heating element that was causing problems. And now when I think about it, there's this thing called metal fume fever that welders know about. And it's one of those things that I learned about, that if people aren't in an appropriately ventilated setting, particularly if they're working on zinc, they can get a problem with their lungs, an inflammatory condition. So maybe there was a clue there all along, but we missed it. And this year, we found it. So there's another bit of coolness related to 2020. Let me move to an email right now. This is from Michael. We're going to come back to news, to stories in just a minute. Some of the additional stories about cool stuff in 2020 include the dark side of antibiotics a couple of articles about CRISPR, one of my favorite topics, as you know, because it involves epigenetics. This one does, so we'll talk about that. But we're starting off with the good news. So let me read Michael's email. Michael from Santa Cruz writes, "Dear Dr. Don, first, thank you for your precious service to public need. Here are my questions. As we are members of the Over 75 Years group, what do we do now? Should we contact someone or do what?" I think Michael's referring to how does he get vaccinated. If we get vaccinated and there is a choice available, which one should we oldsters choose and why? Well, I'm going to start off with the first answer, which is, Michael and everybody, we are inventing this as we go along. It would have been lovely to have had centralized leadership starting, about maybe August, September, when it became clear that we were going to have vaccines, that they were in the pipeline. By the time that the FDA did anything, they actually reached out to the public health departments and they said, hey, guys, come up with a plan. So every single public health department was basically told, figure it out. Well, they are trying, but without a consolidated, centralized plan for how to, among other things, you heard this story this week, prioritize distribution, make sure it goes to the right place, make sure that there's someone there who's the person who's supposed to receive it and who knows what to do with it. That's sort of happening kind of piecemeal. And that's no way to run a massive public health campaign. I have no quarrel with what our local public health department is doing. I have, as a hospitalist, I already received my vaccine about 14 days ago, or no, not quite, about 11 days ago. So I'm actually in good shape from the standpoint of maybe even having a few antibodies because I work in the hospital. And because, unfortunately, I have to be prepared if the front ranks fall, I have to be prepared to step in and help, and I can. So this is a good feeling for me, and I hope that everyone will understand that I was already in the hospital before I was vaccinated. So this definitely takes a load off my mind. But what about everybody else, all the people who are sheltering? I really like what our plan is, and it's going forward from the health department. And so first, we go after all the people in the nursing homes, all the people in congregate settings, all the people where you're living in group homes, because those are the individuals who can set off a major super spreader event. And that's the main thing that we need to avoid. The next phase will be the people who put out our fires and patrol our streets, the peacekeepers, the firefighters, and other individuals who are considered to be essential to just keep everything going. And some of these essential workers aren't real glamorous. People who drive trucks, people in meatpacking plants, keeping the food supply and who keep the electricity on or go out and repair it. These are all really critical individuals. And the last thing in the world you want right now is a 2-week power failure, right? Especially because the vaccines that we've got right now need to be refrigerated. The next phase after the critical essential workers are vaccinated are people over 74 years old. So 75 and up is the actual group. And the decision has been made that we're going to try, this was made at the state level, I believe, if I'm not misinformed, not at the national level. And our state's doing a pretty damn good job too. But it was to use the patient's medical home as the primary point of identification and distribution of vaccine. Some people who don't have a medical home, and we have to come up with a plan for them. I'm assuming that's where the public health clinic will step in and come up with a way to provide vaccinations for those individuals. But I'm not sure how they're supposed to identify themselves. And that's an open question and something that you will be learning about as soon as it's decided. But honestly, it hasn't been announced, so I can't answer that part of the question. So if you're older and you have a doctor, relax, because you will be identified by your doctor. In fact, one of the things I did today before preparing for this program was to run a list and make sure that I had a list of all of my patients who are older than 74, because I needed to make sure, now I'll make sure I've got good contact information, by sending them out a survey and an informative letter and asking for a reply. If I don't get a reply, I'm going to have to make a phone call. Fortunately for me, because I have a small concierge practice, I don't have thousands and thousands of people that I have to do this for. But I do have to make the comment that this is an awful lot to ask of doctors who don't work for large multi-specialty groups. And there's still quite a lot of those in this county, particularly in South County, where the need for prompt identification and vaccination of the population is clearly the greatest. Now let's turn to what vaccine and why. There's some very, very preliminary results coming out of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine that suggest that the RNA vaccines actually produce a more robust immune response in older individuals than younger individuals. Now, this is really good news if it turns out to be true and not just a statistical fluke. And we've got a nice group of guinea pigs, doctors and cafeteria workers and janitors and nurses who all stepped up to the plate this last 2 weeks and got vaccinated, or at least most of them did. And what that gives us is a group that we can watch and measure titers on. And I'm sure that that's being done in the major medical centers like Stanford and UCSF. So we'll know whether that's true, but right now it's truthy. I think by the time it's being freely offered to anyone over 75, we will know if in fact it's better to use the RNA vaccines. Now, this is me, and it's an opinion, and it is a semi-informed opinion. I want to qualify it. This is not based on research. It's based on the understanding of the immune delivery systems. But for someone with autoimmune disease or a history of large inflammatory, not allergic, but large inflammatory reactions to vaccines, I would probably tend to go with the AstraZeneca vaccine, AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, which was approved today, or actually last night, in England for beginning to vaccinate their population. That's a really important vaccine, although it's coming in at 74%. You may remember a few weeks ago we talked about how they made an error in one of the groups that was studying it, and they gave people a half dose for the first shot and a full dose for the second. And they got a better immune response. Don't know if that's just a fluke or if it's true, but if it is true, that is great news. There's also some talk about maybe just giving one shot of the RNA vaccine so that we can stretch it out a little further. And at that point, this is just speculation, and we really don't know how it's going to roll. And folks, you need to understand that the entire world is kind of improvising right now. They don't have all the facts. They don't have a best practices. There's going to be some trial and error, and that means there's going to be some error. I don't think error is going to be critical, but I do think that we have to lower our expectations in terms of messaging being clear and consistent and just look for the messaging as it emerges. Over the course of a month, it became really clear that masks were a really good idea, and we started to see wider spread adoption of that as the data came out that showed that people who wore masks got less infections. It didn't take long, about a month. We've got a month, really, to figure this out and get strategic. And I know that the people who are working on sorting through this and doing the messaging are working their butts off, and they're doing what needs to happen. So please try to keep the faith. Right now, I think I'm going to take a moment, pause, and talk about our last story before the break. And that is a non-invasive test for cancer. Yeah, you heard me right. An international team of researchers in 2020 has developed a non-invasive blood test that can detect whether an individual has one of five common cancers 4 years, four years before the condition can be diagnosed by current methods. That includes stomach cancer, esophageal cancer, colon cancer, lung and liver cancer. The backstory for this is fascinating. researchers had access to 10 years of blood samples from patients in China. This was started in 2007 and ran through 2017. They got a blood test every year during their annual exam, and that blood was banked to be studied. So later on, over time, during that 10 years, as these individuals were diagnosed with cancer, the researchers went back and looked at the differences between the cancer patients and the non-cancer patients, and they were able to identify a very reliable marker. Overall, they had 1.6 million specimens to play with, and that basically gives you some big data. They were able to look at samples from healthy and sick individuals from the same cohort. Let's see, they had 191 out of 600 of the initial study that they used. So they started out with 600 asymptomatic individuals, 191 were later diagnosed with cancers, and they screened for a particular DNA signature called CpG methylation. We'll be talking about that after the break. CpG methylation is the addition of methyl groups on multiple adjacent cytosine guanine sequences in a DNA molecule. These repetitive sequences happen a lot. The methyl groups on them act as signals telling the body whether to run that program and build the protein that that DNA is coding for, or let it lie in abeyance. This is how embryology works. It's also how our bodies work. And our bodies are constantly methylating and demethylating. And turns out there are certain methylation patterns that are highly, highly predictive of cancer. And if you look for them, you can find about 91% of samples in individuals who have cancer but were diagnosed 4 years later, you can find in their blood those early, early methylation signatures. So 88% of samples from the cohort of 113 who were already diagnosed, it recognized cancer-free samples. So that's basically, you've got something called sensitivity. And then you've got specificity. So it didn't have a lot of false negatives, and it didn't have a lot of false positives. I can see in the not-too-distant future, basically running this test, and if it's negative, not ordering a colonoscopy on that patient this year, even though they're due. Wouldn't that be nice, not having to get that particular knock on that particular door every decade, or for some of us who've had polyps every 5 or even every 3 years? This would also be extremely good for detecting cancers in individuals who, for various reasons, aren't going to get screened. This is really going to make it cheaper to find cancer. And I would predict that, assuming that this replicates, we're looking at a real shift in how we practice preventative medicine over the next decade. All right, so we are coming back with a caller. Hello, you're on the air. Yeah, what's your name and where are you from?
I'm Fred, Santa Cruz.
Hi, Fred. Tell me what you'd like to talk about or ask about.
Well, the other day, a friend of mine said he heard that the metformin for diabetics is either laced with, on purpose or accidentally, with, MSM or something, that fuel additive that was banned about 10, 15 years ago here in California, the gasoline fuel additive, which turned out to be very carcinogenic. So I wonder if you know
about that. You mean MTBE?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. That's interesting. Well, I haven't seen anything to suggest that that's a thing, and I think I would have. But there was a possibly a contaminated batch. Let me see. Actually, it wasn't MTBE. It was N-nitrosdimethylamine. Okay, that's NDMA. And they recalled, a certain couple of companies recalled it because it had above the acceptable limit. This is probably a production issue. You can go online and find a list of the recalled products. And
We had something similar happen earlier this year with valsartan, a common blood pressure medication. A lot of this has to do with just chemistry and chemosynthesis. I don't know if you remember the tryptophan and the eosinophilia myalgia thing. This was, at least 15 years ago. But this was where, in a natural substance, that, you know, tryptophan, people were taking it for sleep, and it was very popular amino acid. People were buying it up, and one of the major manufacturers, I think it was a Korean company, but I'm not certain of that, had a bad batch. And the bad batch contained, I think it took us 5 years to figure out what chemical it was, but it caused people to become allergic to their muscles. So they developed kidney damage from breakdown in their muscle fibers. They developed high levels of a kind of white blood cell you rarely see called eosinophils, and they got very, very achy, weak muscles. This can happen, my point is, with a new-to-nature molecule like metformin, or it can happen when you're just synthesizing a natural compound. Chemistry is complicated. I guess what I would say about it is you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, metformin is toxic. What you want to say is, thank goodness people are testing for this stuff and watching for it so that when you do get a bad batch of something, it gets pulled. And that's why everything has one of those little serial numbers on it, because we know that this can happen.
I forgive you for stumbling through all those acronyms. I know it's tough. Somehow you memorize all those syllables. But my next question is, though, as regards something like that, is it true that most of our medications here are made in either China or most likely India, and therefore there's no FDA control, or supposedly no FDA control?
Well, not quite. What happens is that the manufacturer, in order to sell in the United States, they have to be vetted in terms of their manufacturing processes. They have to submit to inspection. You know, it's sort of like farming out the manufacturer of an electronic component in your iPhone to a factory in China, right? Everybody in the global marketplace does this now, and it's all about trying to keep things, you know, it's all about economies of scale and efficiencies and let's face it, cheap labor. So the inspection process does occur as things come back through, and that's how these things get caught. But they are offshore. That is absolutely true. And sometimes you'll get, particularly with natural products, it happens more with them, actually, you'll get contamination. Like, for example, let's suppose that you buy powdered kale for your green drink, and that kale happens to be grown in a field. It was an old landfill. The stuff in the soil is going to leach up into your kale. And I remember reading an article about cadmium levels. One guy published this. He was checking people for toxicity. He was looking for mercury. And he found that his patients, suddenly he was getting all these positive cadmium tests. And the single factor for the cadmium was that these were people who always had a nice, healthy kale shake every morning. It turns out kale is a wonderful concentrator of natural cadmium. And a lot of places with clean soil, not built over a landfill, have enough cadmium to be bioconcentrated to levels that, you know, concentrate in the individuals consuming it.
All right. Well, I had two quick questions because I know other people are waiting. The first one, quick answer, is wasn't that MDMA or whatever you said it was, wasn't that popular 30, 40 years ago as derived from some tree up in Oregon, and not the yew tree for cancer, the YEW yew tree, but some, you know, for all your ailments, I don't think it was snake oil, but it was came and went kind of thing. And then I have a second question. Go ahead.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure which chemical you're referring to that had some popularity back then. The yew tree is, you know, that's an agent that turned out to be, you know, very helpful in a certain kind of breast cancer.
Right.
And so that's where the yew tree came in, and that was about 10 or 15 years ago. But I don't remember about the other. I'm sorry. Can't help.
So, but the other question is, how are these chemicals detected? This is basic chemistry. I forgot mine. How are these chemicals detected? Let's say if I put a pill down or something, is it the molecular weight of these different things exist? Do you know how these are tested?
Generally, it's through a process called mass spectrometry. It's because all of the molecules have certain signature when you heat them up to the point where they emit photons. You're basically burning them under a very controlled thing and capturing the light waves that are released. And the light waves, just like the spectrometry of the sun versus the spectrometry of another star, they're subtly different because the chemical composition that's boiling away up there in that sun is a little bit different. And so lead, mercury, arsenic, these all have a specific signature that shows up when you look at the fingerprint of the product.
So mass spectrometry has been around, spectrography, been around, what, 40, 50 years, 100?
Oh, God, I couldn't tell you. Probably, in terms of this utilization, I would say at least starting in the 60s.
Wow. All right, well, I thank you for all that knowledge, and I forgive you for all those acronyms, and I'll let someone else get on.
Well, thank you very much for the call, and Happy New Year.
Love your show, and Happy New Year. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So let's go to our next email, this one from Pat in Santa Cruz. And Pat writes, "Hi, Dr. Don. I read this article about CRISPR technology and possible epigenetic effects. The article mentions foods but doesn't touch on humans specifically. I love
the dry versus wet earwax gene, for example. You may have the gene for dry earwax, but if it's turned off because the epigenetics aren't there, doesn't mean if the information is there, the blueprint's there, but the ability to transcribe that blueprint isn't there, or it's turned off or folded up, guess what? Nothing happens. These biochemical attachments are extremely important. We've been talking about that on this program for a while. And there is another technique in CRISPR called gene drive, where you go into the germ cell, in other words, the sperm and the eggs or the seeds of a plant, and alter the genes there. That's permanently inheritable. And in fact, gene drives are being used and were used in 2020. It was one of my stories. I guess I'll jump over there for a second and say that gene drives were, in a pilot study, used to successfully eradicate the Aedes aegyptiae mosquito in an area. This is the malaria mosquito. And if you could get rid of malaria by sterilizing the mosquitoes, that could be so that they, or changing their DNA so that they can't be carriers of malaria, that would be awesome. But what about the law of unintended consequences? Well, this study definitely suggests that when we do anything with CRISPR, we're now going to have to go and check the methylation and make sure that we didn't change any of the methylation patterns, either upstream or downstream. In plants, you might end up causing the plants to be very vulnerable to a certain kind of mineral deficiency, or worse, you could potentially turn on hyperproduction of a toxin. Like, plants make these things we call healthy bioflavonoids, and they're insecticides as far as the plant's concerned, but for us, they help us grow our ability to detoxify by exposing ourselves to small amounts of toxins. Come to think of it, that sounds a lot like the breakthrough that I talked about earlier for peanut allergy, doesn't it? It's amazing how when we do these science walks, things loop around on each other. Okay, so let's talk about the other CRISPR story of the evening. And this one is about how do we get these gene therapies into the cells. This is non-trivial. Researchers from UCLA reported a new method this year for delivering DNA into stem cells and immune cells. They were working on childhood cancers and also severe combined immunodeficiency syndrome, which is the boy in the bubble disease. So what they were trying to figure out is, if we take the blood out of the person, how do we get the gene editing done on this blood without using viruses? or chemicals that kill the cells. And the problem is you rip open the cells are like soap bubbles, particularly red blood cells. It's not a very big thick membrane. And if you're careful, you can stick a pin through a soap bubble, but you have to go slow. If you go too fast, you pop it, and, well, that's that. Now we've got the gene editing cut and paste tool, but now we have to get it in industrial quantities to the genes in a whole bunch of cells to do anything effectively. The new technique uses sound waves, which is so appropriate for a radio program, particularly a radio program on a station that plays so many interesting types of music. It's called an acoustofluidic device. They put it in cell culture liquid, and it's like the bass, that little tiny speakers in the fluid create mechanical vibrations that cause the cells to develop little pores, little interruptions, just for a second. And you can squeeze the DNA and the biological CRISPR into the cells during those moments. We also use this technique. You might think about sound waves and how it's used for getting creams and potions to penetrate the cells. Some of you may have been to physical therapy where they used ultrasound and therefore were able to get penetration of a cortisone cream down to the level of the inflamed tendon or the inflamed muscle. The researchers used short strands of DNA called plasmids. They didn't use CRISPR, but the concept would map to CRISPR just as well. And they used blood-forming stem cells, and they pumped millions of them through the device, and the plasmid could be made into a protein that was then produced and identified. So they were able to show that they could correct a DNA sequence that was miscoded, that they could get stuff in there in a safe and effective fashion that did not cause the destruction of cells. So on the one hand, we are now seeing that maybe that's going to be destructive in another way, and we better watch what we do and know what we're doing. And it just got, well, a little bit easier. So kind of double-edged stories on CRISPR. I'm going to go to another email. This from Carl in Joshua Tree, California. Well, Carl, before we go anywhere else, I have to tell you I have very fond memories of learning technical rock climbing many years ago down there in Joshua Tree. And those plants are just so strange and magnificent. I used to think of them as Mars trees because they were just so unlike anything else I ever saw. And then, of course, I saw Romanescu as that became common. And I realized that there's probably a whole lot in the world that I haven't seen. I love the show, and I'm a long-time listener, going back to my UCSC grad school days some 30 years ago. I'm a healthy 69, no doubt part due to some of your tips. Over the years, I greatly improved what used to be chronic sinus problems bordering on asthma in my 20s via things like improved diet, use of a neti pot, and use of digestive enzymes. But I still have some mild issues, like a runny nose when, for example, hiking in the cold, an occasional post-nasal drip at night, which can disrupt my sleep. Lucky me that that's my most serious health issue. At 69, my doctor recommended Zyrtec, but a friend said she'd successfully addressed similar issues with the enzyme serrapeptase. There don't seem to be any good studies regarding serrapeptase, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about whether it might be at least in the can't-hurt category. Well, Carl, you mentioned digestive enzymes, and probably you used plant-based digestive enzymes like bromelain or papain, but you could also use animal-based digestive enzymes and pancreatic extracts because they all do the same thing. They're proteases. They break up proteins. And in the case of using digestive enzymes for allergies, what you're doing is breaking up the antigen and potentially also the antigen-antibody complex gets disrupted. Many people who have low-grade pulse nasal drip actually have some kind of food sensitivity. So it's always good to, first of all, go off wheat and dairy for 3 weeks and see what happens. It's amazing how often
people get better with just that simple intervention. It would be fine to use serrapeptase or natokinase. They're both essentially similar, and they need to be taken in fairly large doses. In what does that mean? It means, you know, hundreds of milligrams at a minimum, and they need to be taken on an empty stomach. So if you go to bed with an empty stomach, which if you're health conscious, you probably do, you could certainly give it a try and see if it works. However, I'm going to tell you about a couple of pharmaceuticals, one of them extremely benign called Cromolyn sodium, that's my favorite go-to if the neti pot isn't doing the trick on the postnasal drip. Cromolyn sodium stabilizes the mast cells. That's part of the allergic response. You have these cells that are studded with antibodies. Actually, the mast cells look a lot like the COVID virus. Of course, they're much larger, but a similar sort of dandelion-like pattern of stuff sticking off of the surface. The idea is that this thing rolls around, and when it encounters an antigen, it attaches to it. And if two of the prongs on the mast cell both attach to an antigen, that triggers the release of a whole bunch of chemicals, histamine, slow-reacting substance of anaphylaxis, leukotrienes, bradykinin, you know, the whole list of things that make you itch and sneeze. So I really like having people use nasochrome. If they have to go a little bit unnatural to get relief, this is one of the safest drugs there is to go a little bit unnatural with. Another agent that I find extremely helpful, although this is truly a pharmaceutical, is a drug that is basically like atropine. And atropine blocks acetylcholine. It's an anticholinergic. It dries up the passageways. And ipratropium bromide, that's ipratropium, you need a prescription for this. The trade name for this is Atrovent, but it's available as a generic, quite inexpensive, and it'll last for about 6 hours. Takes about an hour to work, lasts for about 6 to 7 hours, so perfect for a single bedtime dose. And I'm sure something you won't have any trouble getting your doctor to prescribe. So lots of options for you there, Carl. And thanks for the shout out from Joshua Tree. I haven't thought of those years in a long time, but definitely that was the best part of my residency, was being within striking distance of Lake Arrowhead and Joshua Tree, two very, very beautiful places in our wonderful state of California. Our next story. Not strictly speaking a science story, although it does have medical implications. Besides, I love microscopic monsters, or in this case, itty-bitty tiny things that you could see with the naked eye. These aren't so itty-bitty tiny. These are the Asian giant hornets. They're called Vespa mandarinaria, and Vespa mandarinia. I'm wondering because they buzz like a Vespa motor scooter. And they're orange because they have these lovely orange peel faces on the magnified photo I'm looking at. These were detected in 2020 in the United States. They are known as murder hornets. They are very large, and they have been a real problem in Japan, killing as many as 50 people a year, mostly due to there we are circling around again to something else, due to an anaphylactic reaction. It looks like they're here. The queens can get to 2 inches long with a 3-inch wingspan. That's amazingly big. There are female workers. They get to be about 1.5 inches long and about 2 inches of wingspan. And they're pretty bad too. They're stingers. Can be used repeatedly. They deliver a very, very strong toxin. And unlike most hornets, these guys are social hornets, and they're amazing. They actually coordinate a two-step attack on bee colonies. They're carnivorous, and they love to eat bees. They feed them to their larvae and make more hornets. And unlike honeybees, the queens can live happily together, so you can see as many as 200 of these hornet queens all in a single hive. They love to attack honeybee colonies, and
and they say that 15 hornets can destroy a colony of 30 to 50,000 bees, honeybees, in a couple of hours. Our honeybees, the ones that we have here, are powerless against them. But evolution in action, Japanese honeybees aren't. They evolved a very unique defense against these hornets. They form, and I'm not kidding you, hot defensive bee balls around swarming individual hornets. They basically encase the hornets in their own body, kind of forming an egg around the hornet, and then they vibrate their flight muscles really fast to generate heat. And inside the ball, the temperatures build up to about 116 degrees Fahrenheit, and they cook the trapped hornet to death. It's major, major war down there at the micro level, and boy, is this amazing. So I had to share the murder hornets because, you know. So let's talk about some other good news. Those of you who are penicillin allergic, well, the research is in. You probably aren't. About 10% of the population has penicillin allergy in their charts. But most of these patients either outgrew their allergy or never actually experienced an allergy, but instead had a viral rash or some other form of adverse reaction. So now it's official. The New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association have published studies that show that it's time to delabel the penicillin allergic. In fact, there's a risk score called the PenFest. And what they do is you get 2 points if you've had a penicillin event in the previous 5 years, 2 points if it was anaphylaxis or swelling of your tongue or mouth, or a severe cutaneous reaction, and 1 point if you needed treatment. So if you have a score of less than 3, it was a minor reaction, you didn't require treatment, and it occurred more than 5 years ago, you have a 96% chance that you don't actually have a penicillin allergy. What they did was they took the people who had a low score, and they gave them skin tests, and only 4% of the low scorers with a score of under 3 had any kind of skin reaction at all. We need to differentiate between an adverse reaction and an allergy. And if a person reports that they had mouth or lip swelling or hives all over their body, that's an individual who shouldn't get penicillin without a skin test. But as I said, 90% of the people out there who, or maybe more of the people out there who think they've got a penicillin allergy, actually don't. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this little walk through the weird and wonderful and non-COVID science of 2020. And I'll be back next week to take more of your questions, emails. You can email me at askdrdawn.com between programs. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.